Hi, this is Tom DiCillo, and you are listening to Film Wax Radio. Adam Shark, I'm your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 430 of the podcast. This is a nice, it's just a lovely show coming up here, a lovely episode. We have three segments, and they're all rather economical, essentially. None of them run very long, hence my packing in three different segments into one show. You know, I prefer not to overload the show. But these three conversations, they flow so smoothly and naturally, and all the three guests are so easy to talk to. What we have here coming up first is my conversation with, what do I call, Charles Cohen. He's a real estate developer. That's his day job, as he calls it. But his passion seems to come through film. And so he tells us a little bit about that history and a lot more about what's going on with his distribution company, which is called Cohen Media. A couple of weeks back, or a couple of episodes back, I had on a filmmaker named Marina Willer. And she made a film called Red Trees, and Charles Cohen, he's the producer of that film, and he has also produced a number of films that, oddly enough, most of which he ends up distributing and ends up at a theater that he owns. This one in mind that I'm referring to is called the Quad Cinema, which is here in New York City. So that's now owned by Cohen. It was recently renovated and brought up to today's standards for projection and whatnot. And we're talking about the Quad as well. So in addition to Red Trees, which may not be playing in New York City anymore, but is playing in some theaters around the country at the moment, Cohen Media is also distributing the new Agnes Varda film, which is called Faces Places, or as in the original French, entitled Visage Viage. And it's going to be at the New York Film Festival and then opening at the Quad. So we're going to talk about all sorts of things with Charles Cohen. It was a great conversation. And then after that, we are going to talk to my friend Lana Wilson, who has been on this podcast before. We'll get to more details about her new documentary, which is called The Departure, in just a little while when we get to the segment, which is coming up after in the second section of the show. But Lana Wilson was on previously, twice actually, with her co-director of her last film, Martha Shane, which was called After Tiller, on episodes 102 and 236. This time, Lana went out on her own to direct this new documentary called The Departure, which will be hitting cities in just a couple of weeks. So I'm real happy to bring Lana back on for what I think what turned out to be a wonderful little chat. And then lastly, and we'll get into that, you know, prior to the next segment. And then lastly, I'm very excited to bring on an actor and a filmmaker who I'm a big fan of personally. I mean, this is his directorial debut, actually. But would you believe in his directorial debut, which is called Lucky, and which opens in theaters tomorrow? We're going to talk about it again later in my introduction. But he had in this film Harry Dean Stanton. And of course, we're going to talk about Harry, because Harry just died last week, or a couple of weeks ago. And not only that, but in the film as well is Tom Skerritt, who they have a reunion scene that since Alien. They haven't done a movie scene together. And also David Lynch, doing one of his acting gigs that he's will occasionally do. So it's a great film. Harry Dean Stanton is in like every scene of this film. So it's a real great swan song for him. But we'll get more into that in a little while. First, again, here is coming up is Charles Cohen. Now, I just want to mention, and maybe I'll talk a little bit more. I just want to mention that I've been running around the New York Film Festival press and industry screenings. These are the screenings leading up to the festival. So we go to these screenings at the Walter Reed Theater, which is in Lincoln Center, in the mornings, and we see some. So I've actually been able to see a bunch of films, and I kind of focus on the films that I believe maybe there's a likelihood that I'll bring on some of the filmmakers onto the show. So I've gone to, I saw Sean Baker, his film, The Florida Project, which I liked very much. And then I just saw today, for instance, Richard Linklater's Last Flag Flying. And then I saw yesterday Noah Baumbach's film, The Meyerowitz Stories, which I really, really liked. I liked I really liked Florida Project, and I really, really liked the Meyerowitz stories. But I also saw Griffin Dunn's documentary about his aunt. It's called Joan Didion. The Center Will Not Hold. And I saw Sarah Driver's new documentary about Basquiat called Boom for Real. So it's been so far so good. I have a few more I'm going to be checking out, but it's been sensational to catch up with all these great films. And I'm coming up also as Todd Haynes' film, Wonderstruck, and I'm pretty sure we're going to get a couple of these guys on the show, or in some of the cases, back onto the show. So cross your fingers. I can't guarantee this is going to happen, but I've got pretty good information that I'm supposed to talk to Kent Jones tomorrow, Friday, which is by the way, the day after the festival. The festival opens tonight, Thursday, the 28th of September, but I have not been given an opportunity to talk to Mr. Jones yet. But Mr. Jones, Kent Jones, is the, of course, the lead programmer for the New York Film Festival, and I believe I'm sitting with him tomorrow, in which case I'll have to put up a special episode, of course. Anyway, I've been enjoying this festival very much. Why don't we get to this episode, though? First up here again, the distributor, exhibitor, producer, and real estate developer, Charles Cohen, here only, by the way, on FilmWax Radio.
Adam Shartoff.
Charles Cohen. I just ran into Sheila Nevins.
That's right. She's a friend of mine.
And mine. She was. I met with her last week. She asked me to let you know that that she ran into me in the hall, and that she did 2.5 hours. But I'm not going to request that of you. Well, first of all, Charles, tell me a little bit just about how you came to get into distribution and having a background in real estate.
I was always fascinated by film. I made short films as a teenager.
Did you have like a Super 8 camera at home?
I had a regular 8 camera. Super 8. Regular 8, I did the editing, I wrote the story, I did the cinematography, I wrote the music, and I showed it around, and my first film won the Kodak Teenage Movie Award, honorable mention. I got to go to a film festival and see my film.
Is it over here somewhere?
No, it's probably some attic. And I then did a few more.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was kind of I did film criticism.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's
my
cool.
High school newspaper and my college newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And I.
Talking to the mic, though.
Had an idea of doing a movie trivia book in 1985, which I did. It was 1,000 questions and 1,000 answers, and it was published by Zebra Books.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold 185,000 copies. I made $13,000. It was 3 weeks' work at night. My wife was pregnant with my daughter at the time, so this was way back, over 30 years ago. And they came to me and asked me to do a sequel, and I said, I don't do sequels.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, that's okay. You have the distinction of selling more books than Mark Twain did in his lifetime.
What?
So I retired as a writer. Then?
Well, the question then maybe should be, how did you get into real estate?
Real estate was more logistical from where I was and who my family was.
Sure.
They did.
Sure.
I had an opportunity 20 years later to participate in a film that was going to be a feature by a young filmmaker, a woman, based on a short that she had made that was well received.
Mm-hmm.
Her husband is an attorney that does work for me, and he came to me with a full-blown prospectus on turning this short into a feature and asked me if I would help him raise $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew enough from reading Variety since I was 14 years old. I stopped following the Yankees and I started reading Variety. That a successful film should cost about $500,000, and you go to a film festival, people like it, and you sell it for $1 million. That's a success. So I said, $2 million, come back when the budget's $500,000. So he came back a few weeks later. He said, can't do it for 500. How about 600? I said,
no.
Let me see what I can do.
Okay.
I sent it around. No one responded. And he nagged me, and I put up $300,000. We made the movie. We went to Sundance. We won Sundance. We got 2 Oscar nominations. It was Frozen River. And I was a producer. And I didn't make any, I didn't get my money back. So I realized that I was on the wrong end of this and that I needed to get closer to collecting the money. So the next best place was to be a distributor. And that's why I became a distributor. And now I've become an exhibitor, so I can collect it all.
That's right. You're getting ahead of me now.
Okay.
How did the purchase of the quad? So Elliot Cambar was the former owner. I think
Elliot
I belonged
Cambar
to a...
Elliot Cambar ran it for his brother, Maurice Cambar.
Is that right? Okay.
Yes.
So Maurice was on the premises. Or No.
Elliot was the one on
yes, the hands-on.
He
I got
ran.
It.
He was the manager.
And he was ready to get out. And how did you come about
I had been looking for a theater in New York for a long time. I had been looking to buy a chain of theaters. No luck. Couldn't get to first base. And then I found that there was this opportunity. And it was not an easy deal to make. Maurice Cambar is a very sophisticated and experienced investor. He's a successful inventor. He invented Sky Vodka, among other things. And he had this idea in the 70s of taking this space in a loft building that he had bought, that he was converting to apartments, to take the ground floor. Originally, he was going to do a off-Broadway theater, and then he had the idea of doing a movie theater. And then he had the next best idea, which was to divide it into 4 auditoriums. And this was the first multiplex in the New York area, maybe even in the United States. And it was successful because it divided an audience into 4 theaters instead of 1. And the story he told me was he was a bridge-playing partner of Larry Tisch, and he told him that he should take his theater on 86th Street, Lowe's Orpheum, and turn it into a multiplex, and that's what happened.
There you go.
It was available. I pursued it. I flew to San Francisco, where Maurice lives. We went through whatever we had to go through, and it was important to him that it be maintained as a theater, and that's what we did. And then we set out on this adventure that took 3 years to renovate, 2.5 years.
Now, step in and correct me. I'll probably make lots of mistakes here, but the Cambars had used the quad as primarily 2 things, like running first-run art house films, and also a filmmaker could four-wall their film.
That was in the later years.
Much more recently. And it was like an like a package deal type of thing where they would also get you your reviews and do this, a number of things, right? So the new version, the quad, is now, there is actually one room held for
repertory,
which is wonderful. So now we have another repertory room in the city, which is being run, I would say, a la Film Forum is another way that comes to mind.
I think we're among the best.
Yeah.
Have you been?
Yeah. I have.
We have a great program.
Yeah, this projection is great, and it's comfortable, and a friend works for you running the place. That's nice. Glenn.
Glenn's great.
Yeah. So
great. We're blessed to have Glenn.
And so how does it run? So you have two rooms devoted to first run films and then three. Okay. I was thinking one was, then you can swap out a movie that's doing very well and expand the theatrical, or you could have somebody still four wall. I don't know.
No, we don't do four wall.
You don't? That's what I thought.
No, it's not what it's about. No, it's to embrace.
What's wrong with four walling, do you think?
Because that's not our choice. Our choice is to present what we feel the audience that we cater to wants.
Mm-hmm.
And I think four-walling is just for hire. It's like taking over a catering hall. That's not what we're about.
Yeah, I kind of understand that. And I guess if a filmmaker came to you with their film, you could still take it on, right? But it wouldn't be a four-walling. Is that what you're saying?
That we watch all the time and we decide what we feel are best for our audience.
Right. How hands-on are you as far as the programming? Well, no, let me take a step back. Let's go back to distribution for a second. As far as this film's Cohen Media group decides to distribute, how hands-on are you in that programming?
Very.
Do you go to the festivals?
I do. Mm-hmm. And I've been involved in every acquisition.
Is it just gut? I mean, let me ask you what...
Well, it's my company, and it's when I went into this business, I knew that I had to do it on a person-to-person basis, and I think I've put together a great team of professionals that enjoy doing what we're doing, and I think all of the different skill sets complement each other, and I think that we're doing things that no one else is doing, considering that we embrace preservation and restoration of classic films. We're really about classic cinema in all of its ways, shapes, and forms, producing what we would hope to be known for as classic programming and classic documentaries and some films that we've been involved mm-hmm. with that would hopefully become classics in the future.
Right.
And there's not a film that we release from our library and anywhere else that hasn't had a theatrical release and hasn't been restored. So what you're seeing when you see any of our films is the best projection, the best production, the best way a film should be seen in a theater.
But when you're down to choosing the films to distribute and you're making your, you're going to buy the film,
right.
is that based on a financial imperative or is it a combination of your gut reaction to the film, taste-wise, and emotional connection to the film? It was also, but knowing that, you know, investors have to be paid back and filmmaker needs to make some money and
it's a really
and the film
a
needs
bit
to
of
make
all
it in the
of
theater.
That. Yeah. So not only a bit of all of that, but lately, in order to be competitive in a very competitive landscape,
yeah.
we've actually come in early on when a film is being planned and mm-hmm. Get involved in the co-production side. So that gives us more involvement, more control, and we find that that gives us an edge over our competition.
You already mentioned earlier that you are actively producing, an executive producer on a lot of titles.
Not executive producer, but actually producing.
Okay. Okay, so not an executive producer. Retri's
I've done a few of those. No, okay. Retri, I'm the producer.
Producer, pardon me. Okay. And so that's another level to it. Is that... I spoke with Marina Willer,
uh-huh.
which was a pleasure, just a couple weeks ago. And she talked about she had an idea for her film Red Trees, which is still playing in select theaters around the country, as far as I know. Even though I think the theatrical in New York City is finished. She mentioned that actually she conceived this film as a short.
That's right.
And that you talked her into.
That's right.
Expanding it into
a story.
It's a bigger story
because a uh-huh. short has limited exposure, theatrically mm-hmm. and in any other form. And I thought that this was an important story, and I knew it was important to her, and I thought that's what needed to be done.
And that is a very producerly thing to do.
That's right.
Yeah.
And when I started working with Chuck Workman a couple of years ago...
Who's done the show, too, by the way.
He had an idea for a documentary on what is cinema, mm-hmm. and I produced that for him. And then I was chatting with him while we were making that, and I said, is there a pet project that you wanted to do that you've never been able to do? He said, yes. Uh-huh. I wanted to make a documentary on Orson Welles, so I produced that for him.
That was a good one.
Yeah, I like that. Magician.
That's the one I brought him on for, actually.
Good.
So
he's a good man.
Actually, we met in your conference room, now that I think about it, on the fourth floor. So
fifth.
And his son, Jeremy, who maybe you've met.
He's done a lot of trailers for us.
Oh,
I met Jeremy
sure?
first.
Wheelhouse. Thank you. I have to rephrase it. Wheelhouse Films, I believe, is the name of the company.
Or Wheelhouse Creative or something like that.
Yeah, so he doesn't kick my butt next time he sees me. He's also done.
He's going to direct a movie, right?
Oh, you mean like a narrative?
I think so. He's been trying to do that.
I think he'd be great at it. I mean, he's just one of those natural talent types like his father, right? One of the great documentary filmmakers of the day. So you don't get all the documentaries you try to go to, but what do you like Marina's, is that like Red Trees, is that the type of, or Chuck Workman's films? I mean, those are very different actually now that I think about it. What compels you towards it? Do you prefer documentaries?
I think they're more affordable. And
that's a good point.
I would rather read nonfiction than fiction.
Me too.
I am involved in a number of fiction films, but as far as ones that I've been behind 100%, from the get-go, I think the documentaries are more intriguing.
Yeah, well, you're now, I wonder how, when you're thinking of the project and you've already, you're kind of have your hands on almost the entire way through its trajectory, maybe less of the festival. Although, you know, maybe I'm planting a seed in your mind. Maybe you might get into the festival business too at this, I don't know, maybe.
Well, not in the festival business, but all these films have a festival life.
Oh, sure, sure. No, I was just thinking, you know, that's the only thing you're not involved with in terms of the lifespan of... Or do you have plans to get to the New York Film Festival? Which...
I'm not going this year. Mm-hmm. I went for many, many years. I've seen most of these films at other festivals or somewhere else.
Yeah. Toronto, for instance.
Right.
Were you there?
Places.
Yeah. It's more of a showcase anyway, isn't it? Not entirely, but the majority of the films do have played
in. Having not been in the business of motion pictures for many, many years, I was on the board of the Film Society. Before that, I was a regular at every film festival.
Mm-hmm.
It was a matter of how many films. And I just got to a point where I see these films in other places, and I see so many films during a year that this year I'm not going.
So how does...
I'm sure that we have a film in the festival. I have two films.
I know. I was going to get to one of them, which I'm excited about.
The other is a good one, too. It's restoration. It's called The Old Dark House. James Whale film that we have.
James Whale.
Who directed Frankenstein.
The same James Whale.
Yes.
But, I might have to see that.
You should. It's opening at the Quad soon.
I'll see it at the Quad.
Or at the New York Film Festival.
Well, I have limited time. But I mean, if I had to choose, I'm just saying, knowing that it's going
to
be at the Quad, and
go
it's just
quad.
Another reason
Is
to go to the Quad.
Place to
if
go?
You're listening in, I may need somebody to go with me. It'd be nice to have
on 13th,
get people
West
out
13th
to
Street.
On West 13th, just east of Sixth Avenue. I understand. I grew up in the city, so it's been a theater around since I was coming into Manhattan from the mean streets of Forest Hills, where I was going to live free. Let's talk about Agnes Varda then, because
sure.
You got, you know,
got
this,
involved early on.
This is amazing.
Got involved at the beginning and uh-huh. helped finance the production, and also are doing the international sales.
Mm-hmm.
And we're very excited about it. I was there in Cannes with the standing ovations. And,
yeah,
Agnes.
We're at one honor. What it did one? It was not in competition,
correct,
right? But it's still
highly regarded. And well-received at Telluride, Toronto, uh-huh. and the New York Film Festival next week.
Right. It's exciting. So, and then...
Have you seen it?
No, I'm just...
It's opening at the Quad on the 6th.
Thank you.
Of October.
So you have... What's the name of the James Well?
The Old Dark House.
The Old Dark House.
It's actually
what year
Boris
did that...
Karloff's first film.
Is that true? Wow.
It is.
Yeah?
It's all the truth.
It's all the truth all the time here on... Charles
Always.
Cohen Radio, which I'm just co-hosting today.
Thank you for joining us.
you could, I'm sure you should be doing a podcast or a radio show. I'm sort of serious. Has Sirius approached you about doing something?
No, but you could be my agent.
There you go. Okay.
I'm doing Sounds a TV good. Show on KCET on the West Coast.
What kind of show?
I've done two seasons. I presented 16 films.
Oh, wow. Okay.
From Magician
uh-huh.
was one of them.
Uh-huh, right.
And, you know, depending on the windows when they're available.
Uh-huh. So in our last minutes here, what's coming up?
What's
are you making
that?
More time for film, less time for the real estate side of it?
Well,
or you
I
can't
try to
say
do
that.
Both together.
Yeah.
And I'm not giving up the day job, but I purchased the Larchmont Playhouse recently in Westchester.
Sure, sure, Larchmont.
And that'll become similar to the Quad
mm-hmm.
in some respects.
And I imagine there's an enormous, great audience for
enormous,
that.
Enormous.
They don't have enough there. They're always coming. They don't want to have to schlep into the city every time.
That's right. And it's a wonderful town and
yeah.
a wonderful neighborhood. There's not enough of that in Westchester, so we're excited about that.
And by the way, I do want to mention this. You make a is it going to be like a multi... It'll be a number of,
it'll be four
of rooms.
Screens.
Four screens. So it'll be a Quad.
It'll be a Quad in number of screens, but it won't be the Quad. It'll be the Larchmont Playhouse.
Okay, that's good. Branding
I want to do it
is
as
important.
An old theater.
Right,
so
right,
I
right.
Thought design wise, it should respect its roots.
Good, but that's you know when you have a beautiful theater, you know what happens. Somebody in the locally thinks this is I should start the Larchmont Film Festival here and put it in the new Larchmont. Renovated theater because
I think to have any theater is a festival. And I'm excited about their reception and their encouragement. We have a number of really hard hitting films coming up mm-hmm. behind Agnes Varda.
Go ahead.
In January, we have Ziad Doueri's follow up to The Attack,
mm-hmm.
which is called The Insult, which we're very excited about. It's the Lebanese entry for the Academy Awards. So that'll open on January 27th at the Quad in Lincoln Plaza. And then coming in the spring, we've got Gauguin with Vincent Cassel.
Oh, I love
we've
him.
We've got Rodin with Vincent Lindon.
I love him, too. The mustache.
And love we've got the
my favorite
Michel
actors.
Hassavinicius film, the director of The Artist, called Redoutable, about Jean-Luc Godard
uh-huh.
and his first wife, which is a fascinating film for film lovers. We've got Christian Carrion's new film starring Guillaume Canet, which is called My Son, which is a big hit in France right now. And on the restoration side, we just released Heat and Dust, Merchant Ivory.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
We have Shakespeare Walla coming up in November, also from Merchant Ivory.
Mm-hmm.
We have The Two of Us, Claude Berry's debut directorial film from the 60s. We also, all restored. We also have a new 4K restoration of Philippe de Broca's King of Hearts, which you'll see in early 2018.
Yeah. With Alan Bates. I remember that. That was one of those repertory regular.
It was.
It was a constant rotation.
Anti-war film, one of the first.
Right. Yeah.
So.
It's exciting.
And some others.
But in the meantime, coming right up again, you have Viage Visage or
Faces Places.
Thank you. Which again is at the Quad on October the 6th?
October the 6th.
6th. Oh.
And also on the west side of Lincoln Plaza, and then following in L.A. a week later, and across the country thereafter.
Terrific. And still in some, check around if you're listening to this in the, throughout the country, there's still, I know that that Red Trees is still out there, and it's a very touching.
Did you
see
Red Trees?
Yeah.
Red Trees,
I had on with the filmmaker.
Film.
Filmmaker's
a very highly respected graphic
designer,
artist,
yeah.
And one of the partners at Pentagram London office. And our cinematographer.
She offered to redo my look.
Yeah, he needs it.
He does.
But we have a fabulous César Charlon, our cinematographer, who was the Academy Award nominee for City of God.
Mm-hmm.
And the late Timothy Pickett Smith is our narrator. And does a beautiful job. It's a very haunting, life-affirming Holocaust memoir.
And it's gorgeous, by the way.
That too.
Yeah. It's a beautiful film. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you,
great
Adam.
Meeting you.
Great to meet you.
Yeah.
I'll see you at the Quad.
Okay. It's a deal. Bye. Anna Wilson, again, co-directed After Tiller a couple of years back. And again, you can go to those episodes 102 and 236 to listen to them talk about that film. Lana Wilson is back with her own documentary. It's again called The Departure. It opens at the Metrograph Theater here in New York City, in Manhattan, in Chinatown on Friday, October 13th. I know this, I'm posting the show a little early, which is not typical, but I have a lot of stuff coming up, and so I just want you to make note in your calendars that Atlanta will be there for the opening, at least Friday or weekend, to introduce the film and to do probably some Q&As, I'm going to guess. It will be followed, as I mentioned before, I believe at the Lemley Monica Theater in Los Angeles on Friday, October 20th, with other cities to follow. The film follows a 44-year-old Tokyo native named Nomoto who loves riding his motorcycle and dancing all night in clubs. But he's also a Rinzai Zen priest who lives with his wife, mother, and baby at a temple in the remote countryside west of Tokyo. There, over the last 10 years, he has become famous for his work in combating suicide. But this work has come increasingly at the cost of his own family and health, as he refuses to draw lines between the people he counsels and himself. With astonishing access and artistry, Wilson's camera captures Nomoto at a crossroads, which, by the way, is an expression I use when talking to Lana. I didn't even remember this being in the notes that I'm reading to you. But when Nomoto has a growing level of self-destructive tendencies, and they're leading him to confront some tough questions. Now, the film, I can't recommend it enough. It's called The Departure. Here's my conversation with the filmmaker, Lana Wilson. You're back.
I'm back.
I was we did
this was at the
pie shop.
Yeah.
That's right. 4 and 20
Great.
You, I think I ran into you.
Right.
And you called Martha.
Yeah.
And then she ran
Martha
over.
Martha got on the bus.
Let's go to the videotape. Yeah. Oh wait, can't do that. We could actually. Yeah, it's an audio tape, but that was right after Tiller was about to have a broadcast, and so we said, "Let's just do this. Why not?" You know, the reason I said it is because I actually don't normally walk around with my equipment. All right, maybe I do, but I did, you know, and I thought this is great. What a little opportunity, you know. I like doing things like that. So
it's perfect.
Not that I've ever done it since. I mean, yeah. I only time I do is occasionally at a film festival.
Right. Don't you often though go in a coffee shop and kind of want to interview certain people there? You know, you look at people and you wonder what's going on with them.
Yeah.
I mean, the kind of the cool thing about your equipment, and this is
so
how I feel as a documentary filmmaker, it's an excuse to ask those questions.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I'm a filmmaker, you know, what's going on with this? What's going on with that?
Yeah. One time I was at True False, and I just decided to take a little different attack, and I don't know if people can find it, but it's I actually interviewed not only Dave Wilson, but I interviewed some people just from the area. Mm-hmm. There are so many people that are so into the film festival that lived in Columbia, Missouri. And I just sort of, like, I was sitting with some people, and they were in a restaurant nearby, and they were just chatting and excited. I said, do you want it? Would you mind talking about it?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's part of, I created this ambient thing, which was really a nice idea. So actually, I forgot about it, but in future, like, at local festivals, that would work in smaller festivals, not around a big city. Even the Montclair is too cosmopolitan to try to do that. You know what I'm saying? Certainly not the Hamptons, but as much as I love both of those festivals, like at a place like that where you go to a small town, which is many festivals, of course, that's a nice thing to do. It's like...
Right, where the residents are removed from the film industry.
Exactly, entirely.
Why are you
media.
Seeking out these documentaries, these films? What brings you here?
Like The Departure. We're sitting with Lana Wilson, who is one of my... favorite regulars. Now I can call you for your third visit.
<I'm a> regular.
This is last film, as we said, you made with Martha. This one you went on your own in the sense of directing.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's quite a team. David
I did
Teague,
not make it completely alone. No,
or, you know,
far
like
from
David
it.
David Teague. Mm-hmm. He's the editor.
Yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah,
he's a genius. Yes.
Oh, okay. I got to get him on here.
Yeah.
So if you're listening, David, and you should be, your boss is on. I'm kidding. Collaborator. But so you went this alone, and how's that? Is this the first time you've done a feature on your own?
It's my first time directing alone.
A little nerve-wracking.
You know, it was something I had to do. It was, you know, I think any film is a process of self-exploration. This may be more than most, you know. We're always looking. I think one thing that was surprising to me was that I went to Japan to film with this man who I thought could not be more different than me. I was very curious about him. Nemoto, this priest who's become famous for his unusual approach to suicide prevention in Japan. And I thought, wow, no one could be more different than me. You know, what's he like? What makes him tick?
Mm-hmm.
And I think many documentary filmmakers do, wanting, you know, it's great to film with other people and film their stories because you forget about yourself.
Yeah.
And that's a really rare and wonderful feeling in today's social media driven world, to just forget your own existence for a while and get completely absorbed in the story of life in someone else. So I went over there seeking that. And I think when I met him, I realized how much we had in common.
Uh-huh.
And that was extraordinary to me. And
well,
I think
what was that?
I mean, you know,
he's a former, let's give a tiny bit of background and then come back to your comparison.
Yeah.
He's a former kind of punk, was he like a skateboarder? I forget. I saw this at Tribeca, I think.
Sure, sure.
So it's been a few months.
Grew up loving punk rock, partying a lot in Tokyo, clubbing.
Which for like a lot of people could end up hitting bottom if you go to, you know, especially if you're predisposed for any level of mental illness or...
Mm-hmm.
What have you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which you may not know you have.
Right.
I was going to say, if he's predisposed at all for depression, or I don't remember if he was, but can you imagine if you're partying and you're kind of doing that, and you, I don't know, could you just, it might have contributed to his state of mind. But anyway, go on.
Well, I don't know if he was depressed himself. I think it was more that he grew up And he's always been a person who's attracted to extremes.
Okay.
And who's drawn to extreme experiences to feel the most alive.
Yeah.
So, you know, you could see that growing up in the kind of experiences he was seeking out. He was always very philosophical. He was a college dropout, you know, studied existentialism. And he eventually ended up being a priest because his mother saw an ad in the newspaper that said priests wanted, no experience necessary.
Oh.
They were like, what?
Even and, dropouts
yeah,
can apply.
You know, his mother, who you see in the film, is the kind of person will push him. You know,
sure.
She's like, you need to get a job. You know, why not do this?
Why not priest?
Yeah. And so he got this job, started, and then eventually trained very seriously. Mm-hmm. He went to a Zen monastery for several years.
So we're talking Buddhist priest, not
Rinzai
Christian.
Zen priest.
Okay.
Yep. Mm-hmm. He trained at a monastery. He came out, and he'd always been the kind of person who friends had come to talk about their problems. And I think that when he came out of the monastery, it was, you know, the late 90s. Japan went through a devastating economic recession, a collapse in 1998 that was almost like a microcosm of the global collapse we experienced in 2008. Yeah. And after that happened in Japan, that's when the suicide rate really spiked. In the same way that around the world, the suicide rate spiked after 2008 dramatically.
Okay.
So he had lost people to suicide. He lost his uncle to suicide and two of his best friends from high school and had always wondered, you know, why? And when he became a priest, when he assumed kind of the managerial responsibilities at this temple that he now lives at in a rural part of Japan, west of Tokyo, mm-hmm. I think he thought, how can being a priest really impact people in their lives now? It isn't in Japan. You wouldn't go to a priest for counseling normally.
It's
a very secular country. And, you know, there's a saying that goes, in Japan, when you're born, you go to a Shinto shrine. When you get married, you go to a Christian minister. Mm-hmm. And when you die, a Buddhist priest does the funeral ritual. So that's kind of how it goes. And you wouldn't ordinarily seek out a religious figure for life
funeral
advice.
Home, yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. So he started to think, you know, I could start to counsel people who are struggling with suicide and depression. Combines this personal motivation he has because of the people he's lost with his ability to kind of talk to people and not judge them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So help them.
So we meet Nemoto at a point where he's, would you say he's at a crossroads of sorts at that point?
Yeah. When I met him, he had just had his son, Tepe. He was 6 months old when I met Nemoto. Mm-hmm. And it was clear right from when I met him, it became more and more apparent as we filmed that having a son was this totally new, of course, unfamiliar challenge for Nemoto. It forced him to reevaluate his life and the way he was living it in a very different way. He had a history of health problems. And while I was filming, it got really bad. He was, you know, it was obvious that he was headed for some kind of breaking point because he was working so hard
all
the time.
He wasn't sleeping. He was constantly fielding countless people who were seeking help on one level or another, right? Guidance, support.
Running between counseling sessions
and then
going all over.
Or not waiting for people even, right? He would be constantly checking in with his caseload or what have you. At his own risk of his own health.
It was very stressful. It was working all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was hardly ever at home. And he eventually, I don't want to give away anything that happens in the film, but it's a real crisis for him.
Yeah, right.
And he has to think about, you know, it's different now that I have a son. He's always been drawn to extremes. He's the kind of person who will stay up all night, you know, every night if he had his druthers. But when there's other people in the picture, you know, how to rebalance your life, how to think about it differently, and what really matters.
Yeah, I mean, now he's got a son who's going to rely on having his father around, and a healthy one, ideally.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so this staying up all night and spending day and night, you know, not taking care of yourself is not good for his family, right? Yeah, so it's a lot to deal with.
It's not good for his family, but it's also part of what he loves about being alive.
No,
and that's,
I understand.
The paradox.
It's a conflict,
so
right? That's at the crossroads, essentially. So what do you have in common with Nemoto? What do you feel like you relate to him on?
Well, one thing I noticed when I got there and started filming was that the same concerns that his family frequently expressed about Nemoto, you know, you work too hard, you don't sleep enough, you're not healthy, the patients, the people who came to see Nemoto for help, often express these concerns about me.
Oh, about you.
They would say, Lana, you're working way too hard. You seem incredibly stressed out. You know, are you taking a vacation? You know, you look thin. You're not eating enough. You're going to have a nervous breakdown unless you take a break. They would say stuff like that about me because I think they saw, you know, I'm with Nemoto, so I'm filming with him all the time.
Yeah.
We're shooting all night. We're shooting incredibly long hours. I'm booming, so I'm holding the boom for 8 hours at a time.
Yeah.
They could
I
see
can
that.
Tell your arms are very, very
toned. They're twig-like. And,
yeah. Well,
you wouldn't think I'm a good boom operator, but I've developed skills.
Yeah.
But so they would see that, and they would also, I was really passionate about the film, and I had a certain vision and certain way of shooting it that I wanted to do. So I think they could see I was really focused on filming in a certain way and on getting everything that I wanted to get. And they were worried about how hard and much I was working. They would say that to me. So that was one thing that surprised me. And also just that they're visiting him in the worst circumstances of their lives.
Which is normally very hard to even get out or face the world, right?
Right.
When you're feeling that
But that still they're feeling that bad and that they had the space in their hearts to have all this empathy for me was amazing.
Yeah. That's a good thing.
Yeah. It's definitely a good thing. And that was interesting too because I could see that they were escaping their own problems for a minute by worrying about me, by caring about me.
Yeah.
And I do that. Nemoto does that. We all do that, don't we?
Yeah.
Get out of our own heads and our own problems by being very concerned about someone else.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's always good to get out of your head and not be in your, when you're not doing well in that way.
Right.
Whether it's through helping others, through working, through exercise and run, you know, that kind of, of course.
Totally.
It's an interesting, it's also an interesting dynamic, Lana, that normally it's the filmmaker who might get emotionally involved or there's a I don't want to say a threat of it, but it's, you know, there is in the story with the subjects of their film because of what they're dealing with in their life. And here you have severely, in some cases, severely depressed or self-destructive types of people that you see, and they're kind of reaching out to you, you know. I don't know where you were. Were you at? Were you actually dealing with any levels of being around that? Maybe you were dealing with some levels of difficulty in that.
Mm.
But
was it hard to be around them? Yeah.
Yeah, or just like maybe they did see something in you is one question. Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe they were wrong.
Yeah.
And then secondly, you know, I don't sense you were in that film.
Right.
So you managed to.
You don't feel my presence in the
film. I don't actually feel it, you know, which it sounds like it could have gone that way.
Yeah. Well, I think it's two things. I think what they saw in me, curiosity and compassion. I really think that's it. That they just saw I genuinely just wanted to know about their lives and that I was non-judgmental. They would often tell me I agreed to be in this film because I saw something in your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Like I saw understanding in your eyes or something, which was so moving to me.
Yeah.
You know, and I wasn't depressed myself. I was overworking for sure.
Okay.
I've had horrible days, as we all have.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't think it was that. I think it was more that they saw a kind of non-judgment, compassion, and that I really wanted to learn about them and their stories.
Right.
So I think that was why they agreed. And I also tried to set the stage for their comfort in a way.
Yeah.
Like to be as, say, I'm going to film you. If we film, it's this way. It'll be really unobtrusive. I'll go if you want me to. I think that a lot of people are struggling with what you're struggling with everywhere in the world. And we would talk about stuff in a more general sense, like almost how there's so much pressure on everyone to be happy all the time.
Right.
I think particularly in America.
Really?
Maybe worse in Japan. I don't know.
I was thinking it might be worse because I don't know if there's this whole culture of therapeutic culture like there is here.
And also
if you look on the mass media and television, there's lots of shows and you know, of the idea of confessing is you know, on a emotionally speaking is kind of a big thing here, where I don't know, maybe in the East there's a shame around it. and being going through a difficult period or what have you is looked on as something, yeah, shameful and maybe a weakness, or maybe not even just if that's internal. It mm-hmm. may not be the cultural thing, zeitgeist, but, you know, I don't know. I just think here it's okay to be depressed.
It's
we keep giving pills for, you know, any. Yeah. And I don't want to get far
People
into that.
People have such unique views of this is what's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is a lot of pressure. I think in America, we think we're the best. We're exceptionalists, you know, and I think part of that is there are no bad days. I mean, I think that in New York, it's different. I think that there is more talk therapy. And you're right. There are reality shows that are very confessional and people can talk about their feelings maybe more.
Right.
But I think that here and there, we're supposed to be happy. That's what we see on social media, is people saying, I'm happy, I'm happy, I'm happy. Hmm. But the reality is much more complicated and much more murky. And
sure.
I think the reason the suicide rate is growing in America, and it's actually going down in Japan, is because people, they look at everyone and think, they all look so happy. Why don't I feel like that? And then if you can't talk about it for whatever the reasons are, and I think that you're right, there isn't a tradition of talk therapy in Japan as much as there is here. So maybe it's a little harder to talk about there.
Yeah.
But when you're in that situation, feelings of humiliation and shame can overtake you. And what's dangerous is when someone can feel like it's only me who's like this, or there's something wrong with me.
Being isolated is the worst part of the whole thing. Sure.
Yeah.
But when if you don't feel isolated, there is it is the first step in healing, I think, knowing that you're not alone.
Totally.
Yeah.
Knowing.
Yeah. And that you're not bad, and to have feelings that you have. And a good portion of the film, by the way, Nomoto, who is, again, the priest who, you know, he is, we're hearing these conversations and unfold, you know.
Yeah. Saying, you know, I've been there too.
Right.
I've had my rough patches. I'm a screwed up individual just like you. He isn't talking to them like he's this wise priest dispensing advice to them.
Right.
The
on
sick
his
person.
Pedestal. Right, yep. right, right, right.
It's not the opposite
in the big
of that.
Chair. In the, you know. How? No, he's right there in the...
He brings himself into the counseling in a way that I don't think most suicide prevention counselors do, you know?
Right.
He talks about himself and his experiences and compares himself to them and makes
important.
It personal in a way that's really unusual.
Yeah. What did he make of the film? I assume he saw it.
Hmm?
What did he make of the film? Nomoto, did
he
see
loved
it?
The film. He came to Tribeca with his wife Yukiko and his son
there.
Tepe.
I'm sorry, I missed that then.
No, they all came.
Yeah.
And I showed it to them privately first.
Sure, sure.
Because I think it's the kind of film, you saw it on the big screen, right?
I don't know that I did, actually.
Oh my God, you're going to say laptop and I'm going to start crying, Adam.
It's a very, very big laptop. Okay. I don't remember.
It's fine if you had to watch it on your laptop. Yeah. That's fine. But I wanted them to see it in the cinema.
Yeah, of course.
So I think it's better that,
Well, there are vistas in it.
Totally.
Yeah, that's very true.
And they loved it. I think Nemoto was, because they'd filmed so much for so long, he was very nervous about, what made it in.
Oh, right, of course.
So it was a kind of tense viewing experience the first time he and I
sitting
next
there,
to each other
white,
stiffly.
White-knuckling it, yeah.
Yeah, but he loved it. And even more, his wife loved it, Yukiko, because she was in counseling scenes with him in a way that she'd never seen. I mean, she's been with him so long, she's heard about this work, but it's one thing to hear all about it and to be his partner and all that, but it's another thing to see it and to see him kind of absorbing it all like a sponge. So, and she loved it, and she appreciated, the storytelling qualities, and she watched it 3 times at Tribeca screenings. You know, it was incredible.
I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
And
you certainly catch many more moments with several screenings anyway.
Yeah,
so it makes sense that she would want to see it. So, The Departure, which is the name of Lana Wilson's documentary, is going to be opening theatrically on
October 13th.
13th.
Friday the 13th. Auspicious day.
Indeed. Here in New York at the
Metrograph.
The Metrograph. What a great, of course, I should have remembered. I made a note for myself and then I forgot. Which is a great theater just down in Chinatown. And where else?
Where else? It's going to the Lemley Monica in
LA. Oh, great.
LA.
Okay.
It's
on the same day or is that the later on?
The next week.
The 13th? So,
the 20th. 20th.
2 weeks.
Sorry, 20th
in LA. Let's rephrase it so people don't get confused. So it's opening at the Metrograph on the 13th here in New York, and then the following Friday, the 20th, it'll be at the Lemley Monica in LA. And I assume you're going to go out there
and
meet your loving yeah, fans. We'll and
if there's at least five people in the audience, oh, I'll be thrilled.
There will be, because they'll live and listen to your wonderful
yes.
voice on this show for the third time.
Okay, there are great. More cities too. I can't remember. There's a website, thedeparturefilm.com.
Perfect. Thedeparturefilm.com. And there, I assume it's on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
And okay, very good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, Lana, it was nice to talk again.
Thank
Catch
you,
up with
Adam.
You.
Nice to talk to you
Same
too.
Same here.
Thanks for having me.
Put it there. Last up here, John Carroll Lynch, director and actor. John Carroll Lynch of, we may remember him, and he's been acting in American Horror Story and The Founder. He first came on my radar when I saw him in Fargo, one of my favorite, you know, Coen Brothers movies. So it was a kind of a shock one day when I was doing a Q&A or, you know, moderating a Q&A at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York. And after we went to a party, and there was John Carroll Lynch, and I was introduced myself, in fact, and, you know, just wanted to meet him. And it turns out that his wife had been in the movie that I just did the Q&A for, but he directed his first feature and got this incredible cast, including in the lead Harry Dean Stanton, and I think what would be his last lead role in a film, and it's called Lucky. And it is being distributed by Magnolia Pictures, and it will be in theaters tomorrow, Friday, September 29th. So check it out. There's some great, great surprises in this film and wonderful performances by others, including David Lynch, Ron Livingston, Ed Begley Jr., Tom Skerritt, and Beth Grant. Lucky follows the spiritual journey of a 90-year-old atheist and the quirky characters that inherit his off-the-map desert town. Here it is, my conversation with John Carroll Lynch here on Film Wax Radio.
Realism is the practice of accepting a situation as it is.
What you're saying is what you see is what you get.
But what you see is not what I get. They call me Lucky.
President Roosevelt escaped.
How does a 100-year-old tortoise escape?
I hope he turns up soon, for Howard's sake.
I got this anxiety attack. I fell.
Lucky fell down.
Let's not make a production out of it.
No sign of concussion. Lungs are great, even though you smoke. You get much exercise.
I walk around all the time. I do 5 yoga exercises every day.
Nice outfit there, cowboy.
I was scared to death. I started thinking there's nothing out there. It's all black. The void. Este amor apasionado anda todo alborotado por volver se querer.
Deal with the stress, I think.
Oh, okay. I thought you were trying to, like, raise awareness. Oh, you
no,
were both.
That was a while ago. I was doing both, yeah. During that time,
see?
And then later on, I did it as I did.
Just hold it up here somewhere.
You know, whatever it was, 20, you know, for awareness of suicide.
Yeah, we could even talk about that a little bit.
I was doing, you know, social media push-ups for suicide awareness for
different?
The troops. Oh, very much so. Very much so. You're on your best behavior when you're doing social media push-ups.
Yeah, no, it's, I shouldn't even make light while you're talking about dealing with depression and PTSD
mm-hmm.
coming home, and then it's not.
I just read an article that said ecstasy might help with PTSD.
It's worth a try.
It's worth a try.
I'm going to get my headphones, but I don't even know if I need them, but I'll just like to look professional.
Cool. I want you to feel professional so that I feel professional.
No, this was at the Museum of the Moving Image a few months ago.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember
Chronic,
that
Chronic, yes.
Chronic, thank
yes,
you.
Yes, Chronic, and I saw Tim Roth today.
Get out.
He was at Sirius XM.
Oh, wow.
I waved at him through the glass. Yeah,
what
yeah.
a coincidence.
Yeah, and of course, my wife's in that movie. Brenda Wheel.
Oh.
Yeah, she's in the
I
movie.
She
plays
there.
Michael. Yeah, she was there. I was there with her. She plays Michael Christopher's sister in the movie.
Oh, in Chronic.
Yeah, in Chronic.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's yeah. why you were there.
Yeah.
At the screening, because she was. And I did the. Afterwards, I guess I did a.
Yeah.
Who did I do a Q&A with, though?
The director.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Of course I did. And then And we went out afterwards.
Yeah, and had, I remember exactly.
In this little Italian spot.
Yeah, a little Italian spot. Yeah.
And there goes John Carroll Lynch, and I'm like starstruck because, you know, it's not just anybody. I'm just like crazy about certain
That's very kind of you.
Actors,
you.
You know, that just sort of grabbed my attention.
Thank you.
And, you know, going all the way back. So is this your directorial debut?
Yes, first time I've directed.
The film is called Lucky, and it stars the great late Harry Dean Stanton. The timing of this is kind of strange.
Yes, I mean, obviously he died a week ago today.
Mm-hmm.
So, it is strange, the timing. And it's also fortunate, I think, for the subject matter of the film,
right,
that it wasn't a circumstance where his death may enhance the experience of the movie and not necessarily take away from it. That being said, of course, I sure would have rather sat with him this coming Tuesday and have him see the piece. That would have been
great. Did he get to see it?
No, he never got a chance to see it.
Sorry about that.
Thank you. I know that. I mean, also, the other thing is, I'm not sure Harry Dean would have cared much. I mean, he was a man who lived right now in a way that was really attractive.
Because he was living authentically as he could.
I can't think of anybody. I just think he was purely and completely himself. When I worked with him, there was not a lot of self-doubt in regards to who he was and who he wanted to be in day-to-day life.
Mm-hmm.
He had stopped suffering fools a long time ago.
And there's so many.
I guess so.
Around the time of Sophie Huber's documentary, I was feeling around, and I'm like, I watched it, and then I'm like, oh no, don't even do it, because you would botch it up. Just appreciate his career.
And the life of him. Yeah. The life that he lived.
Right. I know this is kind of odd because it's gone from being a promotional tour of the film to now an ongoing eulogy. Yeah, an ongoing eulogy.
I think of it really as, the movie was intended to be an elegy, right?
A
celebration.
Yeah.
And it was intended to celebrate his skills and expertise and spirit as a, although he'd disagree with the term, his spirit as a performer, the aura he brought with him, and also his worldview.
Mm-hmm.
It was conceived that way and built that way and written that way and directed that way and edited that way. Mm-hmm. Everything about it was about that. So we were all on this board with this same movie. And when that elegy is coming to the audiences and he has died, it doesn't change it from a celebration.
Mm-hmm.
It only deepens my understanding of how important he has been for the past 60 years to generations of film fans.
True. And he's maybe one of only, maybe there was Dennis Hopper. I'm trying to think of those actors, and include females, that has bridged almost every film genre, been at the forefront of it. Like, he's like the guy who, he just worked with all these different great directors and filmmakers and such.
Many of the women who come to mind have passed, like Eileen Brennan those people who've been able to do everything.
Well, tomorrow I get to see the performance by Ellen Burstyn.
Exactly. Ellen Burstyn.
But how many years? She's 84.
She's one who has been able to do everything and she's done it, of course, in mostly leading parts, she's supported, but mostly leading parts. So there aren't, because of the way in which films were built, there aren't a lot of women who have had the kind of prolificness because the roles weren't there.
Right.
Harry Dean just kept working because the roles were there and he was good for them. And he was never bad.
And the irony is John Carroll Lynch, filmmaker, director of Lucky, is... that and I'm like, want to make sure I get the dates right and everything. is that, oh, this is your schedule.
Yeah, what are you looking for?
I'm sorry. I thought it was the press notes. I know you're going to be at Columbia tonight because I actually was up there two days ago, and I saw the posters, and I'm
of
like,
Lucky?
That's funny because,
because
I was there to talk to somebody who works there.
Oh, cool.
Ira Deutschman, who.
He's
like one of these indie pioneers. Like, he's been around for that whole, and he's a professor. He's been teaching there in that department for 30 years. So
fantastic.
He might be there.
Great.
But anyway, Harry Dean Stanton also long career as, with a very maybe a couple of exceptions, but as a character actor, as a supporting actor, in a lot of films. But what's so great here is that you've given him. He's in almost just about every scene, isn't he?
He's kind of in every scene.
It's his POV.
I'm trying to think of it. Is there anything at all in the movie? If there was, I made a mistake.
Yeah, right. No, I could see that. Like this, you kind of have to.
Every scene began and ended with Lucky. That was something that we talked about. And I said, when that didn't happen, the writers and I came up with, the writers came up with some way in which that could happen because it was so important to just follow his journey.
So. Not to go completely off into a new direction, but I guess this will take us there since this is your first feature. And have you even directed a short? I don't know.
Not
that matters.
No.
It's okay. Okay.
Nothing that I would say. I've directed, spoof things for fun.
I got you. I understand.
But nothing that was intended to be.
Yeah. And some pretty great
nothing
push-up
with any
videos
ambition.
That I want to add.
Yes. Yes. Selfie push-up videos. That's primarily.
I don't know what I was doing on there. Maybe I must have been looking for some information. Okay, so how did it come about then? Because normally you would hear first-time feature, especially somebody like you who's been around for decades now, acting for at least 30, 40, I don't know how many years.
I started professionally as an actor when I was, 30 years ago. I started doing films about 23 or 24 years ago, whenever, the year that... Grumpy Old Men came out. The year before Grumpy Old Men came out.
That was you. You were in that one.
Yeah, I was neither. The only thing about that was true was Grumpy Old Men. I wasn't quite old yet. I was a moving man.
Look for you. Moving man number one.
Yeah, moving. Was I moving man number one? Yes. Thank you. Thank you. So now, post Donald Petrie, I'm moving man number one.
Oh, was Donald Petrie? Oh,
he's
that was the director. I remember the name vaguely. At first, I was thinking of Rob Petrie, and then Donald Petrie.
Yeah, he didn't have anything to do with it. Neither did Rose Marie.
Oh, yeah.
Although I did see her at one of my first early parties in Los Angeles. I went to a Christmas party at my agent's, and she was a client. So I got to meet her then. I was in L.A. for 2 months at that point.
Sure, and she was iconic.
And I'm following her on Twitter now.
Yeah. Rose Marie?
Yeah.
Is she alive?
Yeah.
Wow.
She just put out a book.
Get out of here.
No, it's terrific. You should follow. You should definitely follow her.
Oh, okay.
Her push-up videos are off the hook.
Right. I bet they are.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah.
That's great. Wow. I guess Dick is alive,
Yeah, as is Carl Reiner.
Right. Yeah.
So
they could have a reunion show.
Yeah, they could.
Anyway, we digress. So I was going to ask you, I guess, because this is your first time, how did you come to direct it? Because I thought would have written something and then directed
well,
it as
I
a project.
Well, I have written things, but my writing partner and I have a tendency to write things that are troubled business models. They're very good scripts, but they don't fit an easy niche of budget level.
So it's hard to market, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
And also,
so often, because of the scale and ambition of it, I personally didn't feel... I didn't feel like I... If I were to choose a director, I'm a really strict producer. So if I didn't think I could actually direct it, I would not think of myself doing it. But I've wanted to direct for a long time,
I bet.
I've tried to leverage myself into the chair in a variety of ways and never succeeded to doing it. And then this opportunity came through my friend Drago Samundja, who was one of the co-writers, and Logan Sparks, who agreed with him, and we were off. The three of us were. We worked together on the script for about 3 months, and then we got a budget together, and then we went out and got some money. And frankly, when you have an 89-year-old lead, you really can say, we need a quick no. And we got a lot of yeses, and we were off.
Was there a sense that he was on a decline?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No, he wasn't on the decline. It was just when somebody's 89, when somebody's 89, you just think to yourself, we really should get going.
Sure.
I was listening the other day to...
So if you're going to cast Rosemary in anything,
yes,
guys, not listening,
I would
you're
say
listening,
yes now. Go get her now.
And by the way, she should be doing lots of indie films right now.
That's right. Because
she's a perfect grandma. And,
she's...
or whoever.
Great grandma by this time.
Yeah. She's got to be in her 90s.
She's got to be. Got to be. I mean, the pictures that she's showing of her and, you know, Ginger Rogers on, you know, 1940s radio.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
And even there, they're sexy. Even on the radio.
Look, I'll leave that to you. I don't disagree, but...
Oh, I thought we were mid-anecdote.
I think that was the end of that. The end of the sexy
stop.
Rosemary anecdote.
Yeah, I kind of put a...
We were both wandering off into our imaginations about the sexy Rosemary.
I just love older, seasoned actresses, you know? I just... Loving the way, like, or the actresses that came out when I was growing up, you know.
Sure.
So I've had that.
There's also, you know, we have as an industry, we have a difficulty recognizing that people are getting really a lot better at this,
right?
And when you get a chance to focus the energy of production towards people who are more mature, they're actually really, really good at their jobs.
Yeah.
The difficulty is, you know, the marketing and trying to convince people. And I don't necessarily think, this is my own two cents, I don't think it's necessarily convincing the audience. I think it's convincing the executives that there is an audience.
Yes, yeah. Right.
And that's why I'm, you know, so honored, you know, honestly, to even have a little bit of time on American Horror Story, because Ryan Murphy has decided, I know a way to get the best cast on television. I'll just hire all women like Angela Bassett and Jessica Lange and Kathy Bates and Franny Conroy, and I'll just keep going like that because I know how good they are, and, you know, they're amazing actors, so why not use them?
Well, television figured it out, but it seems like that they brought in a lot of, you know, women into television earlier on and there seems to be maybe movies which maybe have always been a little bit more afraid, maybe there's more in the balance, I don't know, but
you know,
maybe they're catching on.
I also think there's this chasing of a demographic, and I don't know, when I was a kid, this is different, this is an interesting conversation, but when I was a kid, I didn't ever imagine I was supposed to be in the same age range as the people I was watching.
Yeah, right.
But with the advent of children's television 24 hours a day, where you have, you know, Sabrina Teen Witch, which of course was a Friday network show, but when you have, you know, show after show after show after show after show, a guy I know, Kevin Sesha, a wonderful writer, just did an Amazon series called Will Versus the Future, and it's a show that's featuring children in this thing, and it's really funny and really smart and charming,
right?
And the intention is to have children watch it, and then they think, well, I'll only be interested in watching things of people my age, which,
right?
I mean, I never wondered how old Alan Alda was when I was watching MASH every week.
I did think about it, but
did you really?
No,
okay.
No, I didn't really. But no, I know exactly what you mean. And coming up and watching the movies in the Midway Theater when I was like a teenager or even younger, there wasn't an industry devoted to the children's movies anyway, so we kind of watched the latest James Bond or the latest, you know, whatever.
That was
kind
absolutely
of, we retrofitted it into our children's movies because there wasn't that much of an alternative.
That was absolutely the case. I mean, I went to see movies that were made for children, obviously animated features and stuff, but when I was growing up, I think I'm a little older than you, when I was growing up, there was a lull of those movies, they were much more difficult to make because they were drawn cells, so they took a lot longer even than they do now.
That's right.
And on top of all of that, there wasn't an emphasis to so what did I go see? Well, I saw what my parents wanted to see. So, you know, I saw movies they saw.
Yeah.
And also there were, you know, the code of what the movies could show you definitely tended towards violence over sex, which it still does.
Right.
But the violence wasn't as violent and the sex was not as severe. So it just had a different kind of relationship.
Yeah. No, I think we're probably in the general same age bracket, I'm going to guess, roughly.
Somewhere in the middle age.
Yeah, whatever they call that generation after...
I technically am a boomer.
Boomer. Yeah, I'm me too. Technically, I'm right on the
63,
cusp.
63. Yeah. I'm 54.
So I'm turning 54.
Okay, great.
In 2 days.
Well, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yeah, so... So I technically just, I'm barely a boomer.
Right. Exactly. We're right on the edge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lucky is coming out in New York and in L.A. and
September 29th.
29th.
And we're playing at the Quad and the Lincoln Plaza and the Rose here.
That's a great.
And they're doing, starting tonight, they do a retrospective at the Quad at Harry Dean Stanton's movies.
Which was, by the way, not planned, of course. I mean, you couldn't do that. But it's just this bizarre
coincidence that they were able to make it all work.
Are you going to any more of that, or you're just here
I'm here for
the film?
I live in New York, but I'm,
you do.
I live in New York. I don't live in L.A. anymore. I moved from L.A. 4 years ago.
Oh, okay.
And then I go to L.A. tomorrow to do some press and to do the premiere, the L.A. premiere, and then we get to go to the Harry Dean Stanton Film Festival in Lexington, Kentucky, to show the movie on Thursday night, and then we go.
Is that
back
an
to,
annual thing? What is that?
Yeah, it's an annual thing.
Really?
It's an annual tribute to Harry Dean Stanton. Yep.
Look at that. Is that his hometown or something?
He's from Kentucky. It's not his hometown.
Home state.
This is home state.
Good enough.
I forget the name of the town, but it was North something. Like he was. It wasn't even the town. It was the North town.
Yeah. Well, those are just real estate developers.
Yeah,
I think at that time,
I think they were more like hollers than they were.
Yeah, I understand. So the film is opening in how many cities?
Well, it starts in two, New York and L.A., and then it starts moving out across the country. We have upwards of 100 cinemas over the course of the run in the United States at the moment.
Yeah.
And hopefully the movie will do well enough expand even more, because this movie's worth seeing. And also this weekend, I don't know when you're going to play this, so hopefully you'll be able to cut this.
Before the 29th.
Okay, well, this weekend, this Sunday, we're part of Art House Theater Day, and there are 60 sneak previews across the country.
Oh, okay. Well, I can promote it or mention it.
Yeah, you should mention it. People can go to arthousetheater.com .org, and they can find where, if anywhere in the country, they're showing the movie near them.
And you will be there live. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
I will. I did have a video, you know, thank you, introduction or whatever. Thank you.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Which I'm now that I'm here with you for 15, 20 minutes, I can say that the video is probably going to be as good.
As good as the movie.
So inappropriate.
It's going to be as good as the film.
No. Not even remotely. I didn't even talk. I will in my intro to this, but I'll just say that Lucky, of course, is an old guy living in a.
Yeah, he's a
town, and he's
he lives in a small. He's a nonagenarian, a 90-year-old man living in a small desert town, and he has a very routine life,
right?
And the routine is upset by a fall one morning, and he has to kind of come to terms with not his health, but with his mortality.
And the film includes for film lovers. Well, a performance by Harry Dean Stanton, for one thing, of course, but and also a reunion of sorts.
Well, it has a few reunions in it.
Oh, I missed
It has a kind of a short reunion because they worked together in Twin Peaks, but David Lynch and he.
Oh, of course. And, David Lynch, which I forgot to ask you about David Lynch.
And then a reunion of much longer gap, which is Tom Skerritt.
Tom Skerritt
and
Harry Dean. Of course. Yeah. That was...
They'd been through the Nostromo together.
Right. Exactly. And then also Twin Peaks and Harry was on that as the park, the trailer park manager, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think. And then, weren't you like sweating and nervous?
No, I was not nervous. I didn't have
ready?
Time. I
didn't have Show time. Me what you got.
I didn't
go.
Have, I didn't.
That's
I wasn't. That was really good. That was a really good day. I knew exactly how. I knew exactly who you were doing.
I bet.
He made me feel very much. He was so respectful. He made me feel very much at home.
Uh-huh.
He obviously made an effort for that, and he kept himself contained in his role as an actor in a really disciplined way. But he also came to play. I mean, he was prepared. He'd made strong choices. He did everything he did in the movie, even when I asked him to do something slightly differently, mm-hmm. was so disarmingly honest and interesting. It was great.
That's awesome. That's amazing. In your first feature, and David Lynch is in it.
Well, gratefully, you know, years ago when I first started doing theater, I was doing a lot of amateur theater and a lot of student theater and stuff like that. Okay. And then I got my first equity job, and for the first 3 days in that, I was like, this is for real. This is professional. And I was kind of freaking myself out. Mm-hmm. And then I realized we were putting on a play. And I was like, oh, I'd done that a lot. I'd put on plays before. Mm-hmm. Oh, this was just putting on a play.
Oh, I see what you mean. So you're making
I've done 50-some films.
Right.
And while I have not been the director on 50-some films, I have been able to, and I've had 200 episodes of television. So I've worked with a large group of people who have been in that chair, and I've been grateful to work with great ones, and to think while I was preparing to do this, both in terms of just before this particular project, but during the particular pre-production of this mm-hmm. project, I was not only able to call on my experience of those people, but also my friends who are wonderful directors who mm-hmm. I could call and say, this is a problem I'm going to kind of have in this particular piece, and I'd love your thoughts about it.
Yeah.
And many of them are on the... are in my special thanks.
And the video.
And one of them was Miguel Arteta, who was just incredibly supportive.
He has a brand new movie.
Oh, yeah, I saw it. Beatrice at Dinner. Really incredible.
Yeah.
Also features singing in it.
I've got it to watch. I'm just...
Well, you'll enjoy. You'll enjoy it.
Yeah, that's another guy movie. I would love to get on here.
Yeah, well, Miguel's a terrific director, and when I told him that I was going to direct, he was so supportive. He was thrilled, you know, for me. Uh-huh. And then he sent me a PDF file of Jerry Lewis's book on directing. He said, I know it's crazy, but I read this once a year. I'm telling you, it's fantastic.
Is that something that people can
really
find?
I'm sure you can find it.
Yeah, because I didn't know if it was like the day the clown died or something.
It's
one of these things that only Harry Shearer has a copy, you know?
No. I mean, it was great. It was great.
That's great.
It was a series of lectures that he gave that he kind of bound into a book. And he had done a lot, obviously had directed a lot. And hosting and making sure that he had such great practical advice about how to run a set, how to start, how to do the work, how to collaborate with everybody. And it was really, really helpful. And then I had other friends of mine, Adam Arkin and Karin Kusama and others who, you know, Adam had made the transition from acting to directing. So I had a conversation with him, and mm-hmm. Karin was incredibly helpful. And as a matter of fact, Almitra Corey, I had met on the invitation. She was the production designer on that movie. So I also took their advice as to who to hire too.
Well,
you don't do these things in a vacuum, is my point.
I hear you, but
it
aligned real well.
In every way they aligned well. Yeah. I mean, just the James Darren casting.
Oh, right. You know?
I mean, James Darren.
I don't think I've seen him in.
Well, what we had another actor who was going to do the part, but because we had the dates for David. The dates locked for David, and he couldn't be there. Oh, and the same thing was true of an actor we had for the bartender, and we ended up with fantastic people. We were kind of in the throes of we were possibly going to lose the person playing Paulie, and Ira Stephen Bear was driving down Mulholland Boulevard to a script conference with myself and with Harry and Logan and Drago, and James Darren was broken down by the side of the road. And he knew Jimmy from Deep Space Nine, so he pulls over and goes, "What the hell are you doing here?"
Yeah.
Well, my car broke down. It's like, wait a minute.
That's bizarre.
You have I can't offer you, but I want you to read this thing. I'm going to send it to you, and you might hear from somebody on Monday.
And he wasn't even like in a poodle skirt sipping ice cream shake.
He wasn't running into the ocean. He wasn't moondoggy. He was
That's
and he wasn't going where eagles dare either.
I don't get all the references, but...
Well, he played Moondoggy in Gidget.
Oh, okay.
All and right. he also
I should
was
know. We're all the same. With We've Richard, already established.
He was also with Richard Burton in I think it's where not Where Eagles Dare. It's the other one. But he plays a soldier in that movie.
Who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? By the way, I want to. I just yesterday coincidentally was watching. I don't know how I came on it, but I was watching a YouTube video. As you know, you get sucked into the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
But this one was with Richard Burton of all people, and he's on the. I think he's on the Dick Cavett show. Yeah. And he talks about his alcoholism. I don't know how to get this file this to you, but you want to see a haunted.
Wow.
Haunted. I mean, you can't get through it without getting teared up because it's that powerful. And of course, because it's the Dick Cavett show, he had like 10 minutes uninterrupted just to talk about what that's like to be an alcoholic. And it was unbelievable. And then he's just saying it spontaneously, it was one of the most powerful things I've ever seen him talk about. I mean, anybody talk about.
Wow.
Incredible. I mean, you can find it on YouTube. Just Richard Burton talks about alcoholism. It'll come up, but it's just remind yourself to do it because it's like stunning.
Very cool.
It's a stunning thing to watch. Cool. And on that note, it's been such a nice experience talking to you and meeting you again. And, you know, I just hope there's another opportunity.
Thank you. I hope so too.
Yeah, this is great. And I wish you all the luck with the Lucky film.
Thank you very much, and I wish you all the luck with finding all those Rosemary push-up videos. You're going to find her on Twitter.
We're on it right now. Thanks again.
Dear Google.
I know the truth, and the truth matters. And you have to face that and accept it.
There are some things in this universe, ladies and gentlemen, that are bigger than all of us. And a tortoise is one of them.
Been very good today, so you get one of these.
What do I do with this? Stick it up my ass?
How about you just suck it?
Thanks, everybody, for listening. We have some wonderful episodes coming up. Who can I announce? Henry Jaglom is back for a long conversation, a career-spanning conversation. Eric Schaefer will be on with a very, very open and honest conversation. Let's put it that way. We have the president of HBO Documentaries, Sheila Nevins, for an extremely long conversation. What I thought was going to be maybe 45 minutes to an hour turned out to be just a little bit longer than that. Let's put it that way. We have Jeff Lipsky, the distributor. He's and film consultant and producer. He's back in the show, as is Ira Deutschman, another pioneer in the independent film world, who teaches film up at Columbia University. He'll be on to talk about his career and teaching students at Columbia and what that's like. And the filmmaker Alexander Philippe, who has a new documentary about the shower scene in Psycho. It's called 7852. And I've got Alexander Philippe on the podcast to talk about that shower scene and his movie and Alfred Hitchcock and much more. And speaking of much more, there is much more coming up. Just cross your fingers so I can get all my guests that I've got in my heart all lined up. You've been listening to me, your host, Adam Chartoff, here on Film Wax Radio, episode number 430. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care of yourself and the ones you love, and we'll be back until next time. Yeah.